Hi, everyone. We're going to get going in just a sec as Zoom, as you all zoom through the Zoom door. All right, I think we'll get going. So good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you are. Welcome to what is the fifth in our live conversations, and at least for me, it's really hard to believe that we're 5 weeks into this working remotely. I hope that all of you are managing well and staying healthy and taking care of yourselves, getting some fresh air, curling up with a good book, binge watching some TV show, baking a cake, whatever it is that helps you relax so that you take care of yourselves, so all of us can collectively help take care of the people that our foundations are supporting. So welcome again. I suspect many of us are now old pros, or at least pros, at using Zoom, but in case you're new to it, I'm going to have my colleague Madeline just do her very quick overview. So, Madeline.
Thanks, Henry. So, you all, like Henry said, are probably familiar with the Zoom platform, but we do ask you that you remain muted the entire time of the discussion and utilize the chat window when you want to ask a question. It's on the bottom bar of your screen. A few people in the chat window are saying that they can't hear Henry, so maybe you want to check your audio levels really quickly. So thanks for sharing that information with us. And back to you, Henry.
Okay, I'll try and speak up a little bit too. Maybe I was being a little quiet before, so hopefully you can all hear me now fine. I guess I also meant to say in the opening, it's really nice to see a lot of familiar faces, people that I know, people whose names I recognize, people who are coming back week after week, and some I don't know personally, but it's still nice to have you with us now. So welcome again. Before we begin today's chat with our guests, though, I just want to do a quick preview of coming attractions, as they used to say at the movie theater. Next week, we're going to use one of the features of Zoom that allows us to go into breakout rooms, and we're going to try and emulate, to some extent, what we might do at a conference or an in-person gathering, where we'll put you guys into rooms to actually chat amongst yourselves. As the saying goes, we'll throw out a few questions, but allow you to share with one another. That's one of the real strengths of our community, is to share with one another what you're doing well, problems you're facing, problems you've overcome, challenges, things on your mind. So we'll mix it up a little bit next week, so we're excited about that. And then the following week, which I believe is May 1, we've put together a panel, or in the final stages of putting together a panel, where we'll have some of you and start talking about some of the financial aspects of moving through this crisis. That's a question that's come up as people have dropped us notes of things they'd like to talk about. So we'll have a few members addressing that. And in that vein, if there's particular things, thoughts, please continue to send them in. They're really helpful. And ultimately, the idea of these sessions is that they're useful for you. So giving us advice is welcome. Now, today we want to concentrate with some health funders and how they're thinking about and addressing issues around COVID-19. And we have three women today, and they all happen to be from Health Conversion Foundation. So Tanera Mee is from CareStar Foundation in Northern California. Vanessa Briggs is with the Brandywine Health Foundation in Pennsylvania. And also from Pennsylvania, Mickey Gula from the Buell Regional Health Foundation. They're at opposite ends of the state, but I now have already forgotten who's in Pennsylvania. I mean, who's near Pittsburgh and who's near Philadelphia. But welcome. So as with each week, I'll chat with each of them briefly, and then we'll certainly move on to questions and whatnot. So let's begin on the West Coast with Tanair. Thank you for being with us today, Tanair. And as always, could you just give everyone a very brief synopsis, brief context setting of what the Care First Foundation does normally?
I've got my phone number.
So that we're the CareStar Foundation, and we are a relatively new foundation. So we were founded and formed at the end of 2017, and we were founded by the sale of an air ambulance company. So from the very beginnings, we had discussions about wanting to stay focused on emergency response. And because of the history of our organization, that's sort of always what we've been interested in. So ironically, this crisis has really shown us that we're definitely focused in the right area and really showing us sort of who the major players are. We are a relatively small foundation, so we've got about $65 million in assets, and we've got 3 staff. And again, we've been around only for about a year and a half making grants.
And your board is roughly how large?
We have a 6-person board, and even that is new. Up until just this January, we were a 4-person board, but we added 3 new folks and 1 transitioned off, so we're just 6 now.
Okay. You said, you know, at your heart, at your core is dealing with emergencies. I think it's safe to say this is an emergency. It may be an extended emergency. Oftentimes we think of an emergency as, you know, a building has burnt down and there's that acute moment. This is really more of a chronic emergency. So have you been doing things differently because of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a little bit yes, and some no, not really. I mean, some of what we were focused on, as I said before, has always been the emergency system and emergency response. I think one of the big differences is that when we weren't in a crisis, a lot of the discussions we were having and the focus that we had was sort of on day-to-day emergency system issues, right? So what's happening to our high-risk and high-need folks who are finding themselves in the emergency response system, either interacting with paramedics or interacting with emergency rooms or interacting with trauma centers, sometimes not once, not twice, but multiple times in a year. What's happening, you know, with those folks that we could be doing to improve their health outcomes and potentially get them out of the loop of our emergency system. So that was definitely the primary where most of our energy was going, intellectually speaking and also financially. And I think this crisis has sort of brought much more of our attention onto the epidemics, and as all of you know, we live in California, so this type of, we have fire seasons now on a regular basis, which often cause us to be sheltering in place because of poor air quality. So this is not new to us, and we've had many conversations about how to be, how to create a more prepared California for episodes like this. This is just much, much bigger and much more intense than certainly our fire seasons have been so far. But I think it's really called attention to the dire and ongoing need for a level of preparedness in our systems and in our communities than it did before.
And when you said these conversations that you've been having internally, I assume that's both the staff and the board. As your board has just, you know, what, grown by a third, if I'm doing my math right, from 4 to 6, is that right? Who's taking the lead on this? How's it evolving?
Yeah, I mean, I would say mostly the staff. We're, you know, we're an organization that, again, is relatively new. We don't have a lot of grantee partners yet, but we are creating pretty intense and good relationships with them. So a lot of this is also grantee-led, as many of you, I'm sure, are doing with your foundations, checking in with our grantee partners and asking them, what's happening for you right now? What do you need? What would be helpful to you? What does life look like for you? And a lot of what they're saying, you know, depending on where they are in the spectrum, but some of the, particularly the smaller nonprofits, are just trying to figure out how to transition to delivering services online or remotely. So that's a big conversation that we're having. And so they're sort of helping us to figure out what's next and what they need to, on an ongoing basis, be able to deliver services when in the fall we're back in this situation.
That's certainly a recurring theme we've heard over these 5 weeks about really communicating with your grantees, really listening to them. Several years ago, one of our members used the expression to me of, our grantees are our professors. They're the ones who ultimately are teaching us. They're the ones with the feet on the ground. So a couple of questions then, Tanir, out of that is, how are you doing that? I know we've heard in the past few weeks, you know, people have done surveys, people have been on the phone, people have Zoomed. How are you doing that? And it sounds like probably a lot of your grantees are relatively new. So I don't know how deep the relationships are necessarily. So I welcome your thoughts.
Yeah. So mostly we've been on the phone with our grantees, picking up the phone. I will say, though, this is an area where I have a lot of mixed feelings. One is the grantees who are able to have a phone conversation with us tend to be sort of some of the nonprofits. We've definitely tried to reach out to some of our grantees who, for example, are paramedics and first responders. So that's they're a big focus of our attention also, just funding in that area. And those are folks that have absolutely no ability to communicate with us right now. They're just way too overwhelmed and too busy. We've gotten a few email communications from them in response to our just reaching out, and they're sort of midnight, frantic, you know, pages long. We're in it deep. This is what we need. This is what we're struggling with right now. And, of course, we've just thanked them profusely for any information that they can provide to us. And in response, as much as possible, we are trying to move money faster, and move money with a lower bar in terms of, you know, all the things that many of us are probably talking about: general operating support, no progress reports are due right now. None of that is being required. It's just move money, they can use it however they want, and get it out the door. Sometimes it's more and sometimes it's faster. It really just depends on what they need.
So when you said move money faster, kudos to you for doing that. Does that mean, and maybe, yeah, I'm curious here, that you're just reviewing things quicker, or has the board authorized you as staff to spend up to X dollars and you make the decision? So literally, if you're on the phone, you receive that email, you can turn around and just, how's that working?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Again, we're still a relatively small organization, so we're able to be fairly nimble. But yes, I did ask the board to increase our grant-making budget for 2020, and no one batted an eye. That was definitely, you know, they gave, I don't even think there was a word of pushback about that, so that was really great. And similarly, when one of our grantees, who happens to be the California Emergency Services Authority, asked for we had a large grant to them that was already approved, but it was multi-year funding, and they asked us to distribute all of the funding immediately. And so that was a very simple request to the board. I, of course, supported that as the CEO, and the board said, absolutely, thumbs up, get it to them. So it's some of just getting more money out the door quicker in that way.
I was going to ask you, it sounds like that authority is some sort of government agency. Is that correct?
Yeah, the quasi-government agency.
So I was going to ask you about working with state or regional or local governments. Are you involved? How does that work?
Yeah. So yes, and we fund private nonprofits as well. We have not yet given a lot of our money to government agencies, but we are tiptoeing in that direction, and certainly the Emergency Medical Services Authority is definitely one of those folks. It's working out okay. It definitely has some additional challenges. Certainly, I just mentioned the word, we're small, so we're nimble. Government systems are not, and earmarking funds can be a little bit of an issue that we've been wanting to address. But we don't want to give up on it for sure, and we particularly want to fund innovation and new projects and programs within government agencies.
I'd like to ask you a question that I've been asked several times over the last few weeks, which is you talked about reaching out to your grantees, having this communication. But people are saying, what if we're not in your portfolio now? What if we're not one of your existing grantees, but we really do fit with your area of funding? Are you reaching out to those people? Are you opening the doors so they can reach into you easier? Has there been a change in that regard?
Yeah, so we've definitely been doing quite a bit of observing, listening, and learning, just watching who's stepping up in different communities and making a lot of phone calls. People have been very generous with their time. I really want to huge shout out to executive directors of nonprofits who are directly involved in the emergency response who are making time to talk to us. We have yet to write a check to a brand new grantee as a result. So in the last 4 weeks, most of our communication and most of our money has been going to existing grantees, but we are now in early stage dialogue with new folks who are really stepping up. The 211 lines are definitely, I know most communities have them, but they've been doing a really wonderful job. And also the VOAS, those are new organizations for us that we're looking into and talking with about what they've been doing and what support they need at this time as well. So it's a little bit of a yes and.
And for those of you not familiar, I mean, the 211 is a, I think it's in all 50 states, most everywhere, a phone number you can call that will connect you with social services, and I've always associated it with the United Way as one operation. And then you use the term VOADs, which are volunteer organizations activated in disasters. And I think we tend to hear of them more with a hurricane, with a major forest fire. But again, it goes to really thinking about this as a disaster.
Yeah.
A couple questions before we move on, although we'll have a chance to come back. What advice do you have, particularly looking at everything from the perspective of a foundation that deals with emergencies? That's your primary focus. What advice do you have for other EDs, other trustees out there that might be listening?
Advice, I think maybe it's a little bit more of a call to action, and I think we'll probably have more of this discussion potentially at the, you know, at the end of the call, but I do think that each of us, we need to be really conscientious as funders about being as grantee-centered as possible, and some of that even means, a few minutes ago I was talking about how much we've been calling our grantees, and I even feel a little bit, I have some guilt around that. They're busy and they're working, and for each one of us to call every single one of our grantees is a tremendous amount of their time. I mean, just imagine somebody's got 10 or 12 funders and they need to spend an hour on the phone with each of them. It's a lot of time in a crisis. And so it's a little bit more, I don't have advice per se, but just sort of a plea or a call to action as a peer group that we be really cognizant of the time and the effort and the work that it takes to get funding from foundations, and how can we be as grantee-centered as possible as we do our work and do our due diligence, but remember where the real work is happening.
Great. I said I was going to move on, but actually there's one question somebody asked specifically. So Jenny's asking, how are you convening your board members during this time, given the time-sensitive nature of everything, and I guess embedded in that, is all of your board local to your general area? Because many of us have boards that are spread across the country.
Yeah, it's a great question. So if I need something really immediately, just a quick question, I'll do it through email. But yesterday we did have our very first multi-hour Zoom call together for a deeper dive discussion. And so that was we've had Zoom calls previously, but they've been relatively short. Yesterday was the first time we actually used all the features of Zoom, and it was fine. I mean, there's nothing that can really replace people sitting together, and the banter is much harder over Zoom, but it worked fine, and everyone was really, really pleased about how it went. Felt like a great day. So
great.
That's how we did it.
Great. Thanks. Vanessa, let's move on to you, and remind me, you're in the Pittsburgh end of Pennsylvania, correct?
I'm on the Philly end of Pennsylvania.
Okay, I had a 50-50 chance. Brandywine is also a healthcare conversion foundation, and so give us, please, the context there in 30 seconds or so about, in normal times, what's the foundation involved with?
I feel like I haven't been in normal times since I started. I can't say that I'm new to the foundation, but I'll be 3 years young into the foundation and specifically hired to manage change. But I didn't think I would be managing our first major public health and economic crisis. And so I say all of that because we are a health conversion foundation. We've been in existence for about 20 years, formed as a sale of our local community hospital. And then since then, we are certainly much smaller than Tanir's foundation. We are a place-based grant-making public charity foundation. So we also do fundraising on the side. So our assets on a good day is roughly around $30 million. And so I was actually brought in because the board was looking for change. We're sort of focused on more organizational and nonprofit organizations that focus specifically on access to health care, behavioral health, mental health. And we wanted to sort of take a public health view of the world from a health perspective. And so when I came on board, started strategic planning, and we were about to launch our new strategic plan, and then COVID decided to show up in the middle of our launch. And so being a small organization of about 3 FTEs, we were quickly able to be nimble and shift our direction. And so we look at the work that we're currently doing now compared to the work that we've been doing in the past is relatively similar in terms of looking at the whole community and addressing social determinants of health. And so we believe that health is much more broadly beyond access to care and services, because where you live really does matter. And so we take our approach to our work through an equity lens, because we really want to lift up the community that we serve, particularly those that have been disparately impacted with healthcare or disenfranchised economics. That's the community that we serve. And so we feel that despite of COVID-19, we're still sort of in the middle of that. So on a normal day, we would be rolling out our new strategic plan and being really excited about that. But we had to quickly pivot and still not lose the sense of what is our overall mission? What is the value that we're bringing to the community in this time of crisis and change?
I think that's a great point, Vanessa, or a great lesson for all of us, that I think all of us are trying to be responsive and be responsible to our, I'll say, communities, whether that's geographic or driven by a passion or a particular focus. We all want to address that, but it really needs to be rooted in what we're always doing. So that, if you've always been an education funder, this may not be the time to suddenly decide, oh, I think I'm going to deal with environmental issues, unless you really have the knowledge. And I think, when you talked about the equity lens, I think that's particularly important, because one of the things that COVID-19 is doing is it's exasperating those kinds of issues. And while on one hand, every single one of us is susceptible because the virus doesn't see color, it doesn't see race or age or socioeconomic value or anything, but we have people who are the most disenfranchised, living on the edge of society, who, they may not have a true home to go to close the door and shelter in place, or they may, in the best of times, have difficulty getting good food, nutritious food, and this just makes it worse. So I think that's just critical kind of stuff. So what's happening now? What do you, what's your day like now?
Yeah, I mean, and just talking about using an equity lens and approach to this work, I'm actually happy that our new strategic plan landed us there. So I felt like we were prepared to take on this work. So we quickly pivoted and created a healthcare and economic relief fund. And we strategically called it healthcare and economic and not COVID-19. Because I'm really trying to address the work that the foundation is currently doing and will do into the future around a public health rubric. And so being a health conversion foundation, we had assets that rolled over to the foundation that were designated as medical emergencies. And so what we did was in this relief fund, because we are a public charity, we turned it into a challenge grant match grant program. So the funds that we had in our medical emergency fund are dollars that we are matching that we raise dollar for dollar. So in lieu of us doing our annual fundraising event like many of our nonprofit organizations are doing across the country, in lieu of doing that, we decided to redirect funds into this healthcare economic relief fund. And so the healthcare component of our fund specifically focuses on medical emergency PPE, supplies, equipment, transition of direct service to telehealth for primary care, behavioral health, mental health. That's the healthcare component. And we've been funding nonprofit organizations, fire, rescue in that space for the healthcare component. The economic side of our relief fund looks at basic needs. Are the members in our community, are they having their basic needs met? Rental, utility, assistance, food assistance, personal hygiene, cleaning supplies, et cetera. And so we were strategic in sort of creating those two buckets because we knew that we needed to stay focused and stay true to who we are as a health foundation, but recognizing that the economics of this is really devastating the communities that we serve. Because we are also raising dollars, we also received a generous contribution from one of our local investors, because the community that I serve in Chester County is deemed as an opportunity zone. So this investor wanted to give money towards small businesses. And so we're now figuring out, well, what does that look like? Because we can couch that under our economic component of our relief fund and help support our small businesses. And so within our fund, we created three phases. First is our rapid response to this basic need healthcare that I just sort of described, followed by moving into what we're calling recovery phase. And in that phase, we will most likely earmark and sort of make a shift to just general operating, long-term general operating support for our nonprofit partners over a 14, 18-month period. We'll also do in recovery, because we believe in our community, long-term recovery, we're still going to have issues around food access. And so we're going to continue to focus on that basic need of just food access, and then also look at how do we support our small businesses as they open up and keep both their employees safe as well as their customers. And is that, from a public health perspective, are we still funding PPE supplies? Are we funding, you know, protection around when consumers go and they need barriers at checkout counters? So we're sort of figuring out, what can we do to help support these small businesses as they open up? And so that's our recovery phase. And then the third phase that we haven't quite figured out yet, because this is all evolving, is stabilization. We know the aftermath of COVID-19 is going to be what people are calling a new normal. I like to say we are just adjusting to be a better self than we already are. And what is that going to look like? Because I do think philanthropy is going to have to show up and do things a little bit differently, and we can certainly can contribute to that stabilization phase.
You know, I was in a conversation yesterday with somebody, and that term "new normal" came up. I mean, I think all of us are fooling ourselves if we think it's suddenly going to be December again in terms of how we operate everything. And I don't just mean philanthropy; everything in our society is going to be changed somewhat. And and you know, hope is not a strategy to say, well, we'll hope it'll go back to that. So I'm particularly happy to hear you talk about, you know, that rapid response, the resources, and then the stabilization. Or, you know, I call it, we're in the blanket and coffee, and then we're in the sort of rebuilding, and then there's the long term. What's the impact? I've got a question because of your being a grant making public charity. You perhaps have more attention focused on you and more outward communication than others might have. Are you helping the community at all understand, and by community I mean not only residents but government officials and whatnot, helping them be aware or even coaching them through some of getting all the money that the federal government is making available and resources that are available to them? Are they on, I don't want to say on their own, like you're totally responsible. I'm just curious.
No, what we have been doing in our county, I'm not the only fund that's been created, so there have been a couple of other funds from foundations and United Way, and we meet on a regular basis just to sort of coordinate, to see who we're funding, what are the gaps we're seeing across the county, and there are two funders in our county that's sort of picking up that mantle to help support nonprofits to interpret the CARES Act or any other of the resources that may be coming down both from federal, state, or local levels. So because we're a small foundation, I didn't want to take on more than we actually could take on. And so what we've done is just tried to be a conduit to accurate, relevant information and connect people to where we know those funders are actually pushing out and providing some level of capacity building. We are toying around with the idea because we have the economic component and we're looking at a little bit about the small businesses. What types of support can we provide for our small businesses? And it's probably going to be more of a linkage and a resource connection to other individuals who have that core capacity and expertise to do that work.
And the last, I'm just trying to be cognizant of the clock here because I'm getting a bunch of questions I'm not going to get to you for the moment. But so what's your advice to others out there, particularly given the perspective you bring to your job every day?
Yeah, I mean, I think the advice, and I think similar to Tamir, I think I often think about what is the aftermath of all of this going to look like and how is philanthropy going to show up differently and operate differently. And so I hope that going through this evolving crisis is that we do lift up the importance of collaboration and partnership among the philanthropic community to minimize the confusion and sometimes the back and forth among some of the same nonprofit partners that we're funding. I think there's room to streamline that if we work collectively together. And then the other piece that I certainly want to lift up is advocacy. I do believe that as a result of this, there's going to be a huge need for advocacy, for policy changes on a lot of fronts within respective foundations and what their missions are. And so I think that, again, there's a role for the philanthropic sector to support other organizations and or be leaders in the advocacy front.
Two great points, the collaboration, the working together. I think that more of us are going to have to do that, and I think we're going to have to help nonprofits come together because I think there may be a sort of Darwinian thinning of the herd if we don't help bring people who are doing good work and similar work together, so that they continue to serve the community. And then advocacy, absolutely. I think oftentimes, first people confuse lobbying and advocacy, and that's a whole separate program. But they also think about advocacy only at the federal level. And sometimes you can get so much more accomplished dealing with your local town, your county, even at the state level in some instances, and really make a difference. Thank you for that. And now let's move to the other end of Pennsylvania. And Mickey, also a healthcare foundation or conversion foundation. And again, Mickey, just the quick overview of what a normal day is like.
Well, a normal day is, again, whether or not we're in a grant cycle or not, we're reviewing those types of things. There are times that we have convened groups, how to write grants, some capacity building type of programs, those types of things. So with this COVID urgency and what's going on, we've worked to try to reach out to the nonprofits that we have worked with in the past. We've been giving grants. We're relatively new at grants, too. We've only started giving grants in 2017. And our primary mission is really to impact people with health-related needs. So in this case, it's extreme health-related needs. We're finding people in our communities who live about, it ranges depending on where you live in the county, where it's more of a rural county, about 110,000 people, with one urban area sort of in the southwestern area of the community. And we have poverty rates as 35% in certain areas, as high versus out in some of the rural areas around 20%. Transportation is an issue for people to get to where they need to be. We have areas, we have food deserts where you don't have adequate food, but you have possibly a dollar store or a fast food store where people are trying to go there to get things. We have a community food warehouse. So what we did is we started with our foundation. You didn't ask about how many, but we have staff. Really, there's three staff. It's a small staff group, but we have a large board. We have about 20 people on our board. And a lot of them represent community organizations, that type of thing, or whether they're governmental organization. We have school representative, we have retirees from heavy industry. We're also considered the Rust Belt, so we have had numerous situations over the last 30 to 40 years where we've had impacts and impacted by decline, and so that, again, is part of our community. So with taking all of those things together, one of the things we did is when we first started out is trying to convene these groups by doing an annual health forum every fall. Most recently, we did it on trauma and trauma-informed care and children who have been impacted by trauma. Previous to that, we've addressed issues related to addiction. And we started action teams with members of our nonprofits. So we have a transportation action team who's been working hard to try to get people connected. And they're continuing to do a good job, though the amounts that they can care for, transport has declined again. People are afraid to get too close. An addiction team who's working hard to try to, we have actually two locations that are very supportive to people in with those particular situations. But what we're finding out really is that food and food insecurity is probably the biggest thing that we're seeing right now in our community, and that's what we decided to start to fund. What we did is with creating this COVID committee, we have about six of my board members, and we've had three meetings so far. And following our last board meeting, we decided to just say, okay, here's a lump sum of money, and let's see what we need to do. So within a week, we were starting to get checks out to people. Now, how we did that, we used the Foundant, the commercial for Foundant grant ranking, but it was great. I mean, we created a three-question application.
Yep.
Basically, who are you, what do you need? And give us some ideas as to what your thoughts are, just very briefly. And we've been able so far to put out $77,000 in funds to probably about 14 agencies in our community, and all of them are primarily focusing on food.
Let me interrupt here for a second, Nikki. When you said you used the Foundant, the online system, three simple questions. So did that make that available to people whether they had been a grantee or not?
It was whether you're a grantee or not, correct.
So yeah. That people who had never received funds from you had
correct.
The opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yes.
That's
yes,
great.
Yes, we did. And we have done some things in the newspaper so that to help people to understand that they are eligible. Now, we do not give directly to individuals, nor do
yep.
we give to for-profits, but yes.
You used a really important word, I think, in your response, we talked about you convene people every year to help educate them. And
yeah.
and you're really, for all of us, regardless of our areas of funding, that's something we can be doing, mm-hmm. educating people in those particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to,
right.
It's not just in health. And I was also pleased, happy to hear the way you phrased it as health-related needs, so that if somebody needs money to get to the hospital to receive treatment, on one hand, that's not directly healthcare, but if they can't get to the hospital, then they're not receiving healthcare. So that, that's an interesting or I think a really important way to think about it. Now, I know that you're a registered nurse.
Yes.
And so how has that helped you? I suppose does every day, but particularly now in this acute situation.
Right. Well, I have worked in the community prior to the foundation as a nurse for about 38 years. and I worked in the obstetrics department, women's health. And I was very fortunate that I was always sort of in on the beginning things, which was kind of an interesting place to be. And I also did some marketing and promoting of healthcare and those types of things out in the community, even with that role that I had. So when this opportunity came through with the foundation, I already had sort of a Rolodex of people that I know who to contact, who's doing what. And being able to launch these kinds of things and start things like this, it was helpful to have people that I could convene and bring together. So that's, and I think we don't always recognize on the surface really how deep some of the needs are and how traumatic some of these situations are for people when they're unable to find adequate food, when they don't have adequate food for their children. One of the concerns now is mental health, because we know from one of my board members runs domestic violence program in our community. Number of domestic violence cases are going up. Children Youth Services are not reporting some of the issues that are out there. Children are home, they're underfoot, families are not always together. State of Pennsylvania, Liquor Control Board is closed, which is very fortunate, probably. But, you know, we don't know what would happen if that wasn't there. So that, again, people are looking for ways to try to isolate themselves or medicate themselves a little bit from this. It is a lot of stress, a lot of tension, a lot of anxiety. What's going to happen to me? I lost my job. Where am I going to? How am I going to pay my bills? Now, we know the agencies in the community who might help with funding rent and utilities. So we connected with them and we funded them a bit. So they're actually, we're not, you know, actually dealing directly with the individuals, because we feel very strongly that the agencies that we're working with in our community, they know our community and the individuals.
Correct.
Yeah, and we're also on a conference call every week with members of the chamber, the Community Action Partnership, United Way, and we do have a large community foundation, but a donor advised foundation. So they also go to their funders and are looking for opportunities to fund certain things. For one thing that we were funding, or they funded actually, we didn't, but they funded, was making masks. We have people making face masks. Okay, out for nothing. Just, you know, they have a sewing machine and they're making them and they're putting them in plastic bags and they're giving them to people all over the community, all over the county. So we also worked with our safety associate, a safety committee on the county level. They were looking for hand sanitizer. They were unable to find hand sanitizer. So I happened to know of a winery who was making hand sanitizer, okay, with the alcohol, with the wine that they weren't using. So anyway, we supplied our police departments with hand sanitizer from a winery. So that's a little small story, but it's interesting that people are coming together in a variety of ways.
So in that western part of Pennsylvania, you talked earlier about being in the Rust Belt.
Yes.
And clearly the steel industry decimated over decades, coal over decades. You know, my understanding is, as you look in western Pennsylvania into Ohio, a high use of opiates, and all of which I think would contribute to just making things worse. And you were just touching on it, but the mental health aspect. I'm worried about that. There's going to be a rise in domestic abuse and child abuse because people don't have those outlets.
Right. No, it is. It is a very. It's a concern. Our Behavioral Health Commission actually has two committees. One, we're working with the University of Pittsburgh as related to opioid addiction, and we have a group through our Pennsylvania Department of Health that's also looking at opioids, neonatal abstinence syndrome, and then we also have a committee that works is tracking suicide in our community.
Yeah.
We, because of a rural community, the access to guns for hunting are readily available. It's very common. People don't think twice about, November we're going out, and they get a deer, that's great, and that means they have extra food for the winter. But also, there's also despair with that, loneliness, isolation. Our senior citizens who usually go to the senior center or have a church facility that they're able to go to, they're not able to do that. And, again, connecting them. We recently funded Meals on Wheels for $15,000 for to be able to go out into those homes and to make sure that these people are okay. Even our chamber made door hangers that people can pick up at a grocery store and says, "Hi, I'm your neighbor. Here's my phone number. Call me if you need help."
Wow.
And we're hanging on people's doors all over the place. So
yeah.
It's little small things that a small community, a rural community, can do without really, there's very fairly creative, but also ways to try to reach out.
Yeah, I mean, great point there, and it's not just small communities, because even large communities are comprised of many small neighborhoods or communities as well. Nikki, what great piece of advice would you share with everyone? And then I have a couple questions I want to throw at all three of you, as Madeline also perhaps chimes in with questions people have asked. But
I would say that that people need to understand that this virus really doesn't discriminate against anyone, and that, you know, particularly people of lower socioeconomic classes probably live sort of on the edge every day, and that, you know, living in these situations, we cannot kind of make pick and choose and say, you can't do that. Okay, you can't do that. You're not living in those shoes. You don't understand necessarily. But by trying to help out and trying to support through agencies, I think we can make a difference in their lives. Because I think that we have to think, certainly right now, the acute situation that we're in, we have to protect ourselves. We have to stay isolated and make sure that people are safe. But we have to all start to begin to, and we can't right now. You can't really think about where we're going to be. You can try to think about where you're going to be, but we really don't know. And so we have to recognize that this has a huge impact on us now, but it's not going to be over in a short time. It's going to be long term.
Yeah, I was thank you. I was chatting with somebody recently, and we were talking about this. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts, so, you know, the famous blizzard of 78 or other big blizzards where literally the state came to a halt for a week or 10 days. But you knew it was ending, and it was not something that you could catch by going outside, that kind of thing. And so, you know, as you said, as I said earlier, I think, you know, this virus knows no bounds. And so that there's great lessons to be learned there. So I have a question for all three of you, and, you know, please chime in as you like. But what do you see, particularly coming at this from three different perspectives in health, but somewhat similar in health? What do you guys see as the greatest immediate need that all of us should be thinking about, we should be acting on?
Well, I'll go first, I guess. I guess trying to reduce the spread of it. When they do say, in the state of Pennsylvania, the governor said, wear your mask, get your mask on. If you're not going to wear your mask, stay home. I think that's just really being blunt about it. But I think we have to try to make those efforts to keep safe, to keep others safe. The education is important. Wash your hands. Wash your hands as many times as you can say that. That's important. So that's an immediate need. I think down the road, I think we're going to have to look at economic issues. We're going to have to look at how people have been impacted by this, even from a health-related as well as mental health-related needs develop.
It's, this is certainly the proverbial rainy day, and it's the time to take action and do things. Vanessa Kinnear, the greatest, greatest immediate need that foundations should be thinking of, funders should be thinking about?
I think that's a really good question, and I'm trying to think of something that's uniform across all states, all counties. And I'm going to go back to, we're all in a position to deploy resources to nonprofit organizations. And I don't want to lose sight of, how do you get resources to those smaller grassroots organizations? Because oftentimes, they're the organizations that certainly have their finger on the pulse in terms of where the greatest need is within a specific geographic area. And they're also the group of individuals that can be galvanized when you want to put into action around when testing is going to roll out. They can help to sort of mobilize around that and determine best places. So I just don't want people to lose sight of that grassroots organization that has their finger on the pulse as to what's happening. And the capacity that they bring. They may not be the sophisticated, well-oiled machine, evidence-based nonprofit organization that we may fund, but there is a role for them, and I don't want people to lose sight of that population and that group of organizations, because again, I'm looking at it both short term and immediate and long term, and I just think policies and understanding how systems have been fragmented along the way and how the public health infrastructure has to be put back together is going to impact all of the work, I think, that philanthropy plays. So that's what I would add.
Okay, I want to come back to that grassroots remark in a moment, but first, Tanir, I'd love to hear your response to the bigger question.
Yeah, I mean, immediate, I think it's been said, I think Nikki and Vanessa have both mentioned it, I think immediate, what we're hearing a lot about is food access and food availability and just, you know, for our homebound folks, just getting food to them. I think, you know, for our vulnerable communities, any reduction in income is becoming a huge problem, so being able to pay rent. That feels like the immediate need. Another thing that I want to just echo, and I think it was Mickey that brought this up, something that we're hearing a lot about is the increase in gun sales right now. Mm-hmm. So gun sales are surging, and the data show that every time gun sales are surging, it is followed by increased numbers of violent episodes. So we already know that violence against children and intimate partner violence is increasing now, and we believe that that's going to spread to community violence numbers and statistics in pretty short order. It's an immediate concern that what I think will unfold into longer-term areas to just keep our eyes on and pay attention to. It's a huge area of concern for us.
Yeah, and I think, Tanir, it requires all of us to not just be thinking about that now, but to be planning for that and within the context of what we do in our communities and what roles we can play, because it's, philanthropy, and I count myself here, you know, we're really good at being reactive.
Yeah.
We're all great when Flint water was discovered to be deadly, and everybody came in with all kinds of stuff, but I think we all can agree that there's probably a lot more Flints out there, mm-hmm. but we aren't dealing with them, so we need to think forward, and what are we going to do in our communities? Is this going to be an issue here so that we're ahead of that curve as opposed to trying to catch up? But Vanessa, I want to jump back to your grassroots part, which I totally agree with you. But so my question is, are you, and really, you know, Mickey or Tanir as well, are you coordinating with other funders in your area so that all the money doesn't go, everybody thinks they're giving money to, you know, nonprofit A and B because they're the well-known or what, and so they get all the money and the grassroots get left out. Is there coordination going on? Is there sharing? Are you telling each other among other funders in your communities, here's an opportunity, we can't handle it, but maybe you can to help those small off-the-radar organizations that are so vital?
Yes, that's actually happening at both the local and the regional level. Within the county of Chester County, where my foundation is located, we do coordinate. I mentioned there are multiple relief funds, and so we have weekly calls where we're talking about who we're funding, how much we're funding, what are the needs that we're seeing, and where are the gaps. And so hopefully with this conversation, we can start to direct the resources to some of those, you know, non-traditional nonprofits that we typically would not have funded. So that's happening at the local level. The regional level, our Philanthropy Network of Greater Philadelphia region, they're convening weekly calls within the region that includes 10 counties, including parts of New Jersey, Delaware, and obviously Pennsylvania. And we're coordinating who we're funding, what are the types of funds that are out there. And so we've started to see funds specific to childcare, funds specific to immigrant populations, funds specific to grassroots, small businesses. And so we are all on a call every week talking about who we're funding, what are we seeing, and where are the gaps, and then supporting each other's funds when appropriate. And then the last piece I'll add is that they're now starting to carve out space for data collection across the region, because that's the story to tell when you have X number of funds in a region that encompasses 10 counties. Where are those dollars deployed? Where are their opportunities? Where are their gaps? Because in the future, we'll know where to specifically target those populations, those communities that unfortunately may have and continue to be marginalized.
Question for all of you. It was put up in the chat box, I think, fairly early in our discussion by my friend Ted, and it goes to the issue of impact. All of us in this sector, you know, for years have talked about impact and how do we measure it and how do we do this and how do we do that. Are you thinking about that in the, what I hesitate to say, has become the traditional way these last couple of years, or are you just not worried about, you know, trying to go in and measure very specifics and reacting maybe more heart than head? And, you know, is that a good or bad thing?
I mean, I can speak for my foundation. I think the data collection is important for all of the funds that I mentioned that are currently helping to support these communities, because that's going to tell a big story both now and into the future. In terms of my specific foundation, I'm not leaning towards data because I already know the communities that I serve have been disparately impacted, economically disenfranchised for 30 years. So I don't need any more data to tell me. And I know that, unfortunately, these are also the individuals that are part of the frontline workforce that's trying to fight, you know, the COVID virus. So for me, it's about how do I minimize that population from being exposed, is that working with the county to coordinate testing, targeted testing spaces and places where we know the virus could show up and or already exacerbated. And so for me, it's not about the data right now. It's understanding the data that I was working with and how do I mitigate this population from continuing to be further disimpacted and disenfranchised. That's the lens, and that's using the equity lens that you've been talking about at my foundation for the last year and a half.
Mickey Kinnear, do you have thoughts on that post-impact question?
Yeah, I think that, again, just keeping connected with the agencies that we have funded, how is it going, what have you, you know, and a lot of it right now, because we're doing food, is how much are you getting out, what are you doing, how many families, what's the increase. Looking forward to seeing those who, you know, have job losses. I don't think we've really touched on that or know where that is. So that, again, is going to, if we're going to see increases, we need to know that a little bit. I don't really want to burden them. I think sort of like what Vanessa was saying, in some ways you know who they are and what's going on, and I don't really want to take extra time from them to say, okay, we've got to count all this up right now. Some of it is trust with them and working with them and just touching base periodically, not to take up too much time, but checking in, how are you doing, what's going on, and then so that when they get a chance to catch their breath, then we're able to maybe have a little bit more of that conversation so that, as Vanessa mentioned, as in the future, we maybe will have some data so that if this comes back, we'll maybe be able to respond a little differently if necessary.
Do you guys feel, maybe this is a guess, but do you think at some point when the dust starts to settle, and I don't think it's going to settle for a long time, but as it starts to settle, that your boards are going to be looking for evidence of impact in you know, that sort of statistical, specific way, or are they going to be content knowing that you supported this food bank or you help the EMTs in town by providing masks and gloves and gowns and not counting how many runs did they make with them or some of the things that I personally think sometimes you get a little ridiculous over.
I think my board's going to be happy with knowing we met the immediate urgent need that unfortunately is happening as a result of COVID-19. And I think because we're sort of taking this three-step approach with rapid, basic needs, recovery, stabilization, that we're beginning to build blocks. So, for instance, if you use the example of those nonprofit organizations that provide direct service provision to low-income communities around primary care, behavioral health, and mental health, and if we have begun to fund the transition to telehealth or some modified version of that delivery, that we're now creating a new system and building infrastructure of that nonprofit that will continue to have utility COVID, with COVID or not COVID. And so I think that's how they're going to be measuring the success of the organization, that not only was it urgent, responsive, but it was strategic in a way that it also has future utility into the future. And we've been talking about integrated health services and integrating all these programs together. And so telehealth is one way, and then how do you continue to build upon that? I think that's how we're going to be measuring the success of what we've done over a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm. Danair, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, impact is such a, it's just an area that I struggle with, particularly as an organization that is funding across the state of California to essentially impact the, you know, emergency response system, right? We live in a nation that does not have universal health care. We live in a nation that doesn't have a single healthcare system or entity. And yet we have an expectation of ourselves that we're going to be able to measure an impact on this vastly disparate system. So it's tough, and I want to be able to do it, and yet need to be realistic about the challenges of, first of all, how long it takes to have an impact, what impact might look like. You might want it to look like something at the very beginning when you think about what you want to do, but it might look really different at the end of the day. Yes. So internally, we've just had a conversation that was very much inspired by a lot of the thinking. We've been revamping our systems in terms of reducing the size and number of questions in our application process, you know, for future use, just to have it much more simplified, and doing the same thing for any kind of progress and follow-up reporting. So one of the things that we were talking about doing is implementing a pre- and post-survey of our grantees, first of all, asking them to set their own metrics for success, but particularly the area that we're interested in, which is around partnerships and collaborations with other entities, to have them self-describe what improvement would look like and to sort of give themselves a number at the very beginning of our grant and then to ask at the in the middle and at the end, what does it look like now? How does it feel to you in terms of improvement in your relationships with the other entities that are working alongside you in this ecosystem? That's what we're thinking about doing, and then hopefully we'll launch that in the next couple months.
Great. I have one question for you before I'm going to go to Madeline and see if there's stuff that I know there's been stuff in the side chat that I can't keep up with. Are there things that you would like to happen or are happening in terms of your boards taking care of you? And are there things that you're doing in terms of taking care of your staff colleagues? We always talk about caring for the caregiver. So is that happening? Is there stuff you would like them to be doing?
I have a fairly quick answer. I think my board's fantastic. They've been super supportive. I think in the first couple of weeks also when the sheltering in place just got started, I just sort of said to the board, my entire staff, there are three of us, and we are all women with school-aged children at home. So I certainly sent an email out saying, we're still working and we're figuring this all out, but I need you to also appreciate we are simultaneously trying to figure out how to become school teachers, as well as, you know, implement cleanliness systems that didn't exist before. So if you can just be patient with us as we're trying to navigate these new and multiple roles. And the board was just so supportive. So that's the board. And I think I feel really grateful to be the leader of an organization and to be able to just sort of set the tone of we are human beings first. This is a really difficult time. It is an unprecedented time. Many of us are trying to not only role model for our communities, but also for our families and our children who are home with us all day, and how important it is to show up in the world in the way that we want to be and the way that we want others to be. So I feel like we're in good shape there, and I feel really blessed.
Great.
And Mickey, from our perspective, my board's been very supportive. We have two of my staff. One has young children, a two-year-old and a five-year-old, and she has been home. She actually was quarantined because her husband did have a flu-type symptoms, but fortunately did not have it. So she has been off, and she'll be off for probably another 8 weeks or so, depending on how things go. And my other colleague, she also has children. They're high school children, so they're all working on their laptops at home and that type of thing. But yes, they're supportive, and I think, you know, understanding. And, I mean, they all know. I mean, everybody knows. We're all in this together. I think that's what we have to consider. It's not only those people or somebody across the country, but it's everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would just sort of echo the other two that my board has been extremely supportive, and when I have a need, we have an emergency meeting either with the executive committee or the full board, and they're very responsive. What I have done, I've noticed that daily we have check-in calls with my team, and they're an hour, but they usually last about an hour and a half to 2 hours because 30 minutes is just sort of self-reflecting and showing up as people. So we allow that space and time to happen, and I'm hoping in the future we'll continue to do that. And then I think for how we're sort of holding everybody up and lifting each other up is just, I'm just trying to be as transparent as possible and not just constantly focus on number of grants, how many dollars did we get out in, and what was the need, and what was the need. And so I communicate weekly to the board with updates around what's happening in the organization, and I include my team, so that they can see the communication that's happening between myself and the board, because I feel like these are times where people can actually feel a little bit more isolated and not connected. And so I'm really trying to hold everyone together so that we're all sort of in this together. And my board has stepped up and begun to thank staff, and it's just been, which is not that they haven't done it in the past, but it's much more deliberate, and I think it's because the communication is just open and transparent, even though we're not seeing each other in person.
I think that communication, that checking in, is just so important, even if you're that sole staff, truly sole staff foundation, checking in with whether it's family, whether it's friends, whether it's grantees, but being respectful, as Tanir said, if these are EMTs that are just constantly on the road, you don't want to bend their ear. On the other hand, there may be times when they want their ear bent, when they can just relax. So you gotta put up your radar there and figure it out. But I think that human socialization is going to be so important for all of us as this goes and continues along. I have one final question for you, but before that, Madeline, are there one or two questions that have come up that we should be asking?
I had to unmute myself before I started talking. A lot of the questions that were in the chat, all of the speakers touched on already, but there was a lot of active discussion about people who posed questions and then others responding. So that'll be on the website on Monday for people to go back to for a reference.
Okay. Good. Then I'm going to ask the three of you for one final question for just, you know, relatively short answers. I think we've touched on this a lot already, but what do you anticipate is going to be the most important ongoing need that your foundation is going to face? Now, I know, you know, Vanessa talked about the multiple stages, but just, you know, over the next 3 to 6 months, because this is still unfolding. I'm not sure any of us truly, I think we grasp the magnitude, maybe, but we don't understand all of the specifics. So what are you going to be really concentrating on the next 1, 2, 3 months that other people should be thinking about?
we want to help organizations to learn from this episode. So when things kind of calm down a little bit and folks have the capacity to debrief a little bit and figure out what it is they need or want to be able to do differently, that's something that we want to help organizations to do. And whether or not that's through general operating support grants or, again, continued pauses on deliverables for other projects, whatever that looks like, we want to support organizations to hit the pause button for a second and figure out what they need to do better next time.
Great. And Vanessa?
I think I'm going to have to echo Tanir. I think it's just really being laser focused on the viability of our nonprofit sector and how much we can support them. And so that's why we're shifting to long-term general operating grants right now. And then really being intentional about funding grassroots organizations and making sure that they don't get left behind, because they're already working on shoestring budgets, but I, as you've heard me say, I think they add tremendous value. So just being real intentional about how you engage them in a way that's going to be very meaningful and helpful for the future.
Right, and you, as you said earlier, you came into this this whole virus with that equity lens already embedded in your work, and I think we all need to think about equity in every sense. It's racial, it's socioeconomic, it's religious, it's going to become employed, unemployed. It's people who may have disabilities that prevent them from accessing certain things. So really important point. And Mickey, your final word.
Okay, I guess I would ask or encourage them to communicate, collaborate with each other, learn from each other, not duplicate, not double it up. We do this. Well, we all are trying to do this. Again, so again, tying, just looking at those words and those to try to get them to do that, which is sometimes difficult because I think sometimes some of our poor nonprofits, today they're on one side of the desk talking to someone, and tomorrow they may be on the other side of the desk looking for help themselves. So we have to recognize that and relate to that too and try to help them because it's fearful and they're struggling too.
You know, there's the old expression about, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And sometimes it's used maybe a little cavalierly in a world where you could, you know, even with your mask, just walk down the street to get some fresh air and you could be exposed. I think that truly matters this time in ways unlike in the past. Madeline, any final thought for people on how to share and continue sharing?
Yeah, as always, I'd encourage everyone to take this discussion that we had on here into the discussion community we have online on our website. If your question didn't get answered and it fell through the cracks, post it there, and a lot of people will come and assist in response. And thanks again for coming this week, everyone.
And thanks, Madeline, for your help. Mickey, Vanessa, Tanir, three really strong, bright, inspirational women, thank you for sharing everything today and what you're doing. We'll look forward to seeing you next week, everyone. As we said, we're gonna try some breakout rooms and let you talk to one another. I've also come to realize in this past week that if you haven't fallen into that 1 or 2 degrees of separation from somebody who's been lost due to this this virus, you probably will be. So for those of you who do have those losses near and dear, certainly our sympathies go out to you, and let's all keep washing our hands and trying to help the communities we're working with and see if we can't eventually beat this thing. So thank you all, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.